Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, you know, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How's everybody doing this morning? I feel all right. I hope you're doing good. It's Wednesday morning. Riley, how you doing?
I'm warm.
Yeah, it's hot,
it's
dude.
It's hot. It's
God,
sticky.
It's hot, man. It's oppressive. You got to, you know, you got to, you might not even know when you get heat stroke. That's what my wife was reading to me, the symptoms of that. You get dizzy, you get disoriented, you feel nauseous, your stomach hurts, your head hurts. You could be getting heat stroke.
But wait a minute, that's every morning before I come in here.
Oh, well, then maybe it'd be harder for you to tell, I guess, is what
yeah,
the point
absolutely.
Of that is. But I feel that all the time. When the humidity comes down, sometimes you just sort of like, am I getting sick? Do I got the flu? Do I have malaria? Is this Ebola? What's happening? Is this West Nile? Can't be that. They sprayed me while I was sleeping.
Really?
I don't know. They always say that. They're going to start spraying the West Nile in Queens. I always hear that.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to start spraying the West Nile bug repellent spray. And I don't even know how they do it. What, do they fly planes over? Do you have any idea, Riley?
No, I think they do it like, if they did it the way, if they're doing it the way they did it the first time with West Nile, they actually have like the trucks, you know,
so it's trucks?
Almost like sanitation trucks.
Do they make a, do they have a song like the Mr. Softy truck? That's not ice cream.
We're going to kill mosquitoes.
That's pesticides. Hey, I also went running. I think I got to be honest with you.
I worked out yesterday, too.
You did? I made you feel guilty, didn't I?
Because
I
was sitting. No,
it was time. I did admit it.
It was time.
After the show, I was like, when was the last time you went, Riley?
Yeah, it was a week ago.
But this was weird because I'll be honest with you. I've been doing yoga on Saturdays. Okay, I'm not going to hide anything. And, you know, I'm not going crazy, but I go on Saturdays in Astoria. And yesterday I took a run, and I think it made a difference because my breathing, like I didn't get tired at all. I felt great, and I was listening to that Radiohead album, Hail to the Thief. Man, let me tell you something. That album, you got to listen to that in its entirety because there's no way you can break it up. If you break it up, it's useless. It's meaningless. It has no resonance. If you listen to it in its entirety, you lose track of time. It was perfect. Perfect running music. It's a good record. Though, you know, I get a little tired of their anti-hookness. You know what I mean? I don't need a hook. But I'm saying one, it's not going to kill you. One, I mean, come on. I know you did Freak. You know, or Creep. I know you did. There's a couple of songs, beautiful pop songs that had a couple of hooks. And I like a hook occasionally, but I do like Hail to the Thief. And I'm not going to get into it with Radiohead fans. They're geniuses, okay? So that aside, let's go to space. I got to be honest with you, Riley. I'm watching that shuttle lift off yesterday. I'm excited. And I'm not a space guy, but I'm excited. You see that footage from the wing camera of it taking off. You see the Earth, but you really see it going away fast and fading into the background. So they pulled it off. They blasted off with their crew of 7 yesterday, and it was a beautiful launch. I enjoyed the footage, and this is the first shuttle blast off in 2.5 years, and that time that was spent making the thing safer. Because it, you know.
Well, let's knock wood, okay?
Apparently, they made 50 safety improvements to the shuttle in the wake of the Columbia disaster. The fuel tank was redesigned. Did you realize, Riley, I had no idea that the shuttle is one of the most complex vehicles ever built, ever made. There's 2 million working parts, 300 miles of wiring.
Well, you're trying to do 17,000 miles an hour. It better be complex.
2 million parts.
Yeah.
I mean, can you believe that? And we're sitting here talking about the fuel gauge, and we're making fun of these guys. Just imagine what they had to go through just to get to the fuel gauge. But apparently, it may not be as safe as, you know, you might think it is. Apparently, there is something that broke off yesterday. They saw something peel off. They're not sure what it was. They think it was paper that was on top of the thrusters.
Yeah.
I don't know what. But we'll find out. They actually are going up. Part of the thing they're going to do up in space is figure out how to fix the shuttle while it's in flight.
While it's in flight. That's been a very big problem. But this launch was not without its casualty.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the shuttle toasted a bird on its way.
I'm sure it toasted
seconds
many.
After liftoff.
You just heard about the one. I'm sure there's many fried birds. You could probably go and have a full buffet of fried birds. right there on the ground in Florida. But apparently, I'm not going to let apparently be my new In 113 missions, the shuttle has been hit with debris 15,000 times, so this isn't unusual. And apparently NASA replaces about 100 insulating tiles after every flight and repairs more than that after the thing comes down. And apparently, I knew I was going to do it. I'm going to get addicted to it, apparently. Look, here's the deal. The thing is not that safe. It's dated. It's from the 80s. They need a new model. It's going to cost billions of dollars. So unless Americans are really into the space program or they can get that kind of money, they're going to be keep using this thing that was built in 1981. It needs to be updated. There are definitely, you know, there are core issues with this shuttle that can never be fixed just by virtue of the fact that it's a dated piece of machinery, and that's the reality of it. Hopefully nothing's going to go wrong. I enjoy the fact that people are flying around in space. Apparently they're going to be experimenting with glues and pastes and putting tiles together. I guess if they run out of stuff, they can stop at the Home Depot satellite.
Or Lowe's.
Yeah, there's a Lowe's space station. You know that's going to happen. You're just going to see the Home Depot parking lot in space. Yay!
And we'll all be in a Jetsons episode.
Yeah, so tell me about Pataki talking about not running for gov. Again, is that because he wants to be president or just because he wants to stop? What's with that guy? I can't get a pulse on that guy. I don't know what he's all about. I don't know what good he is. I find him boring and hard to look at.
Well, there's been speculation, Mark, for the last 2 or 3 years that he would not run for a fourth term. Four terms in New York are killer for governors. Okay, Mario Cuomo tried to run for a fourth term as governor and got beaten by Pataki back in 1994. There is some talk that he is testing the waters for the presidency. As we talked about when he went out to Iowa a couple weeks back, he's deluding himself. I think he's really kind of angling for that all-important ambassadorship to the Vatican or something.
Yeah, because
Vatican? Why would he want to go to the Vatican?
Because that's the easiest ambassadorial gig. You don't have to do anything.
Kayla's going to Rome. I'm going to get you that stuff. Did you bring in that travel guide? When are you going?
I'm going in November Thanksgiving.
So that's a long time. So why don't you bring me that Lonely Planet? I'll write down the places we went. Cool. You got to get yourself some of these fried artichokes in the old ancient Jewish section of Rome.
Ooh. Yeah,
I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to tease you a little bit.
I don't know if he wants to go to specifically to the Vatican or maybe the Court of St. James or something, but he wants something that is relatively easy. I don't think he wants to run for political office. I don't really think he wants to be president. I think he'll test the waters, and then he'll find that Rudy Giuliani's made them too hot, so he'll get out, and he'll hope that if a Republican wins in 08, he'll get an appointment.
Come on, he's actually got a shot at being president of the free world?
He's wanted to be president
Do you think he has a shot for real?
He has a shot at making the nomination. Yeah, he's a very popular guy among Republicans, although not among conservative Republicans.
Right. By the way, Chris, that Jewish section in Rome, it goes back to like before Christ. So it's not Hasidic. They actually wear togas and sandals, the Jews, in that section.
Oh, cool.
Togas. No, I'm kidding. Wow. Why would you even just let that wash off your back like that? What, you think that's serious? Huh?
Well, why wouldn't I?
Because I'm sorry.
Come on, the ethnic stereotyping doesn't start till 7 Eastern.
Anyway, so look, Senator Frank Lautenberg and 26 Democratic senators are holding a press conference and have signed on to a letter authored by John Kerry calling for hearings for Congress to investigate the leaking of covert CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity. They are irritated, to say the least, that not one hearing has been held on the matter, which is pretty mind-blowing. One aide is quoted as saying Republicans in the House issued over 1,000 subpoenas for information from the White House during the Clinton years. Today, those Republicans just sit there doing nothing to get to the bottom of a potential felony. Now, John Kerry, also speaking up, said, quote, Americans deserve a Congress that holds Washington accountable for the truth about our national security. Can anyone argue with a straight face that Congress has time to look at steroid use in baseball but doesn't have the will to provide congressional oversight of the leak of a CIA agent's name? It's long past due to stop putting politics ahead of the public good, get to the bottom of a national security breach, and restore credibility to Washington, end quote. This is actually something that Kerry does well, these type of investigations and mobilizing this kind of energy. But Lautenberg is pissed off at Alberto Gonzalez. There is a 12-hour gap between when Alberto Gonzalez found out that the grand jury was convening on the behest of the CIA to investigate the leak of the identity, of when he called the White House. He called Andrew Card immediately, but after that, there was no one else alerted for 12 hours.
Yeah.
12 hours. So this is the gap they're holding in on, Riley. This is great, because now they've sucked Gonzalez into this. He's put himself in there, but the Democrats aren't going to let up on this. The Oval Office and the West Wing are starting to stink. Karl Rove stinks. Scooter Libby stinks. They can't even find friends anymore to even stand up with them, which is beautiful.
Well, remember that at this time, Alberto Gonzalez was not Attorney General. He was White House counsel. He was the in-house guy representing George W. Bush. Now, Gonzalez's excuse was, well, I found out at 8:30, everybody knows people in Washington go home by 6, so there was really nobody to call between 8:30 that night and 8 o'clock the next morning. The fact of the matter is, however, that that kind of investigation and the gravity of that kind of investigation would seem to say that Gonzalez should have told somebody in the White House, aside from himself, that this thing was going on.
He told Andrew Carr, didn't he?
Yeah, he told Andrew
Carr. All right, so Andrew Carr, the White House chief of staff, who's a bastard, an evil, you know, creepy little covert bastard himself, so he did tell somebody. He told the one guy that could have set into motion a shredding campaign or an obfuscation campaign or a campaign to start hiding crap around the White House because he knew this was coming down. And I think it's very telling that this White House no longer has anyone to rely on to come to their side, to the point where not only do they smear their own. Remember, Joe Wilson was one of their own. The CIA, you know, operates at behest of the White House, and they exploited them and then blamed them because the CIA didn't want to be part of their lies, and they got caught in a lie by Joe Wilson, and he was a Republican. And now they're going after Larry Johnson. Little Larry Johnson, he's a guy who's on our show. He's a former a CIA counterintelligence guy. He's a CIA analyst who was one of them before 9/11, and now he's, you know, he did the response, the Democratic response to the, or I guess the response to the President Bush's radio address.
Yeah.
So they're going after him, and they're using Jeff Gannon to do it. They got no friends left, people. It's beautiful. Let's just really quickly, we play that Lautenberg. We play, this is Senator Frank Lautenberg talking to us a few weeks ago.
I'm ready to go to war to make sure that Karl Rove, who loves trying to identify people as scoundrels and calling them names and suggesting that liberals coddle terrorists while they get after them, and here this man had the audacity to look for others to blame, get people punished, and he's the guy who tells all.
He compromised national security. He's guilty of treason on some level, isn't he?
I certainly believe so.
And that treason has led to an exacerbation of terrorists globally. We're going to get into what's being done here in New York in just a second. It's 18 past the hour. Good morning. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Is it Wednesday? I believe it is Wednesday.
Yes,
isn't
it is.
It's Wednesday morning, middle of the week. I'm feeling a little more peppy than I usually do on a Wednesday. Is that all right?
That's fine.
I didn't have any coffee or nothing. Had some pancakes.
What? Pancakes?
Pancakes in the middle of the night. Pancakes, my friends.
Oh, don't worry. You'll flame out about 8:22.
You want to hear some? These are happy hippie pancakes, buddy. These are oat and barley pancakes I made for my wife. How do you like that? Finished them up. What are you shaking your head about? What's that, Kayla? What's the problem? Doesn't mean I can't put butter on them. You know what I mean? Doesn't mean I can't put syrup on them.
Is that not against the hippie code?
Hey, there's no hippie code, man.
Is there a special syrup you put on? It can't be maple syrup, I'm sure.
Of course it's maple syrup. Maple syrup's very hippie.
No, it's not like hemp syrup or something?
No, maple syrup
hemp
is...
Hemp syrup.
This is where you're making a big mistake, my friend.
What's hemp that? Sap.
Maple syrup is by nature hippie. Yeah, anything that comes out of a tree that you can use to make cakes with, that's hippie. Do you understand? Unadulterated maple syrup, pure hippie.
So,
hemp syrup.
So how'd your wife like the pancakes?
She loved the pancakes.
It's like living with my parents.
It's like a, it's a, oh, you know what? That's absolutely right. Because you know what I say after she eats the pancakes? Please clean up your dishes. Can you clean up after yourself? How many times do I got to tell you? That's what I say to my wife.
I do that to my girlfriend too. I'm like, could you flush a toilet? Like, is it so hard?
Ooh, that's a little different. You know, but there is a hippie rationalization for not flushing the toilet.
What's that?
Save water.
Exactly. There's a save water thing. Personally, I don't like it. Let's move on. Look at this. In the New York Police Department sent their explosives guy to London to study the suicide bombings and explosives used in that bombing. The bombs in London apparently were crude, highly unstable, and made from a combination of acid, acetone, and peroxide, which forms TATP. These are all commercially available chemicals, all right? The NYPD has started to contact a lot of chemical suppliers and other commercial sources for suspected sale of these and other bomb components. This is stuff, this is the kind of stuff they should be doing, actually.
Well, this is the same kind of grunt work, by the way, that they did when they started taking down marijuana growers on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. They started looking at where people were buying the pipe that they used to water the plants. They started looking at the amount of electricity people use. There's a lot of different ways that you can tell that people are involved. And this TATP, by the way, was used by Richard Reed, the shoe bomber.
Yep, and this this stuff, the high you get from this particular chemical compound, much different than the marijuana.
Yes.
But so this trip is part of a broader effort on behalf of the New York Police Department to reach out to international companies. Apparently what this is, this to me makes me a little nervous. This makes me a little nervous, Riley, because this is a big new business. The security business is a big new business since 9/11.
Yeah.
And a lot of these things that people came up with after 9/11, a lot of these guys who are selling security devices or security systems, they're hucksters, they're con men, they're like anything you've ever seen in the history of American capitalism. They see an outlet, and this is a big new business. But I think it's impressive on some level that the NYPD is reaching out to find some technologies that may work for the city. But they have been ripped off before. That makes me a little nervous.
Well, see, what you have going on here is the NYPD essentially talking to itself. In New York, many of the people who head private security firms, whether it's for hotels or restaurants or personal security for individual Wall Street people, they're all ex-cops. So when Ray Kelly brings them all together, many of them are people that served in the department at one time or another anyway.
Well, but it should be something that the Homeland Security Department should have some sort of standard. And whether the states want to engage in it or not, they can. But they should have some sort of standard as to what things are effective and what things aren't. I mean, apparently, got to stop saying that, L.A. got screwed on about 100 bomb-resistant trash cans that were recommended by the Homeland Security Department at $1,500 a pop. And they were proven to be unsafe to be used underground in some situations. I don't know exactly what those situations are, but I mean, there should be something, some standard set by Homeland Security that should be something they do that says we recommend this for real reasons, not because we've got a sweet deal or we've got friends that we're helping out, we got a contract, this is a port contract or what have you. There should be some real standards in place.
Well, see, when you look at the New York Police Department, you got two things that jump out right at you. Number one, Ray Kelly, the current commissioner, was a former counterterrorism person with the federal government. So he knows this stuff already.
Right, and we're going to tell you a little bit about racial profiling. We'd like to hear your ideas again. This seems to get people going. 866-303-2270. They diverted a plane. Why? Why'd they divert the plane yesterday? Really? Hang out a second. 27 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
With Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. So what do we do? What do we do? You know, if it's unconstitutional to search people, if this is a reality we're going to have to deal with, if people can just point at people and get them arrested, isn't that bad? If people can search our private things, that's bad as well. Do we just count on technology making the jump? Do we change policy? Is a change in policy, is fighting for a change in international policy going to be remedy enough, quick enough? You know, what is the process? You know, everyone's got a lot of ideas like, hey, that's unconstitutional. Hey, that's surveillance, man. Hey, you know, we should change policy and everything will be okay. You know, everyone's got these criticisms, but I have not heard word one of any practical solution from anybody that's ever called this show. You know, it's just criticism and it's just, that's wrong or this is wrong. Yeah, maybe we should change policy, but what's the practical solution here? You know, I'm just tired of people just, you know, being critical. vehicle without having any follow through. The truth of the matter is the world is screwed up because of policies that we're engaged in, you know, around the world. But how am I sitting here going to facilitate change in that? And is that something we can bank on? You know, it's easy just to say it's unconstitutional, man. Okay, fine. It is unconstitutional. But what the hell do we do to stop ourselves from being blown up? What's the process? Who do we trust? 866-303-2270. You know, sometimes it's hard to figure out what really is being said in the news. Thank God we got this iNews Wi-Fi headline translator 5000 machine. Let's feed it some headlines. All right, from the Associated Press, GOP presses for timetable on Roberts' vote. GOP presses for timetable on Roberts' vote. Translation, GOP, hurry, the facts are gaining on us. From Newsday, Hillary Clinton says U.S. off track since Bill left. Hillary Clinton says U.S. off track since Bill left. Translation, all is forgiven. Come back to bed, Bill. From Forbes, stem cells restore heart function in pigs. Stem cells restore heart function in pigs. Translation, culture of life may collide with culture of bacon. There you go. All right, so, you know, look, you know, here's the deal. We had this problem in New York where a guy who works at a tourist bus agency, Gray Lines, calls the cops, says there's a 5 guys on the bus, on a double-decker tourist bus, that are acting suspiciously. Bam! The cops show up with a squad of armed people, take everyone off the bus, put these guys on the ground, cuff them, and then let them go. This cannot be the way it happens. Bloomberg has blamed the bus company. He's also apologized for the incident. And I think that's rightfully so on some level. On another level is, look, if someone's a suicide bomber, and that's really what the suspicion is, they're going to blow themselves up either way. You don't get on the bus. And this is, you know, for cops. I mean, just put a couple of uniformed guys that go on and do it like you do at any other search. Just sort of, excuse me, fellas, can we talk to you for a second? That's it. But this is even worse. There's people on an airplane. An airplane was diverted. Flying from Los Angeles to London was diverted because people on the plane were uncomfortable with 3 Arab-looking men who did turn out to be Pakistani who were making them nervous. They were running up and down the aisle because apparently 2 of them were in first class, 1 was in coach, and they were talking to each other, and people freaked out. The horrible thing about this, Riley, is they diverted the flight. They landed it in Boston because people were uncomfortable on the plane. I mean, is there no faith in any of the security actions we put through? And can't people just, I've been on planes with Arab people before. And, you know, you have a moment. Everyone has a moment where like, oh, good. No, great. All right. But, you know, I fight that because I know it's wrong. I know that's just fear. I cannot believe they landed the plane.
This sounds an awful lot like human error. In the case of the Sikh men here in New York who were on the tour bus, the original information apparently was that they all had knapsacks. Turns out there were none. In the case of the diverted flight, you're talking about people who simply were going back and forth between first class and coach. Somebody got suspicious. And again, it comes down to human error. We see in Egypt, they detained 5 Pakistani men in connection with the Sharm el-Sheikh bombing. They let all 5 of them go. They had nothing to do with it.
But is it just human error? There was a chain of command here. I mean, it's like a passenger said to a stewardess, hey, what's up with those guys? Or maybe 3 passengers said, what's up with those guys? So the stewardess goes, wow, I don't know what's up with those guys. Let me go talk to the captain. And the stewardess says, there's some guys that are talking and making people nervous. And the captain goes, wow, well, let me see what I should do here. We got some people that are acting suspiciously. There is a chain of command that is honoring a moment of fear that just explores a couple of things. People don't trust the security devices that are in place now, the security standards, like checking people at the airport, checking people that are getting on the plane. They have no faith in the structure at all. If they're going, and neither do the pilots, neither do the stewardess. No one believes that we're really safe, because if they did, they wouldn't have landed this plane. They got locks on the doors. Theoretically, these guys didn't get on with bombs. They don't have guns on them. And if they had box cutters, that crap isn't going to work anymore. They can't get into the cockpit. But they, obviously, no one had faith in the security devices and the standards that were put in place, and they landed this plane.
Well, yeah, and there were no air marshals on the plane. Remember, after September 11th, there was some talk about flying federal air marshals intermittently on some U.S. flights. What we're seeing here now is paranoia. What we're seeing here now is people saying, look, you know, we're nervous, and when we're nervous, there is apparently some kind of procedure in place where there are certain actions taken. In this case, they actually land the plane in Boston. They search everything. They let the plane fly on, and they fly the three Pakistanis who were actually innocent people who were the targets of all this. They flew them on a separate flight.
Yeah, and after questioning them and realizing they were just they were not suspects of anything other than being Pakistani. Now, here's the other issue: is that okay? So let's say we put this technology in place. They've got this new technology we talked about a few weeks ago out of Los Altos. This PixLogic. This is technology that will take pictures from videos, match them up with mugshots or other videos. Or suspects, and be able to ID people in real time through this, you know, interactive database, which is, I think, what they're building with some of this stuff. The MTA apparently is making a big sort of storage database of people who have taken pictures of bridges and reservoirs and subway stations.
That would literally be tens of thousands of people.
But they're moving towards operating this technology, which we've seen in movies. Would that be okay with civil libertarians? Would that be a more effective way if we didn't know what was happening and we were just being surveilled? Or is there really no solution to this? Are we really screwed because of our foreign policy? Let's take a couple calls. What's going on here? Steve, why am I talking in New York accent? Steve in Rochester, how are you, Steve? What's going on?
Hey, Steve.
Hi. Yes, you made a comment about, well, what can we do? I mean, and you're speaking about ways in which we can address these things on a very low level. And what I'm calling about is how to address it as far as what's creating this condition that we have in the world.
The international level, the foreign policy level.
Exactly.
Okay.
Endless war, endless conflict. We're always, nations always going to war. Well, there's a professor at Stanford University. His name was Anthony Sutton. He died a couple of years ago, but he worked at the Hoover Institute, a very conservative institute.
Okay.
He had written quite a few books detailing the fact that Hitler, Stalin, Mao, these people were all funded by these huge bankers and U.S. industrialists, brought into power, and they made huge fortunes off the war that came about as a result.
Okay, right. So you're saying that we've got to reassess how the corporatocracy on the planet works and how the people are being duped by fear and how they're being exploited by foreign policy and how that leads to terrorism and the crap that we're in now. So you're talking about, you know, starting at the top and rethinking everything. Now, is that really possible? Is that going to happen in my lifetime? I mean, I believe it's possible. I don't know what has to happen for that to happen. But, you know, I'm talking about, what about when I leave the office today?
Well, the biggest problem is that we need a free press, and we don't have a free press. This organization also, they pretty much have muzzled the press.
Okay, that's absolutely true. Thanks a lot for your call. I understand what he's saying, and I understand the broader issues of foreign policy, and I think he's absolutely right.
Well, you know what? Later on today, we're going to talk to somebody about an expert about American foreign policy and how it's creating some of this jihad that we're seeing.
This guy's an interesting guy. I was recommended to me by a listener of our show, and I appreciate it. He's a University of Chicago professor, Robert Pape, who's going to surprise you with what the profile of a suicide bomber really is. It might surprise you to know that it's not all about jihad, my friends. Ernest, how are you, Ernest? What's going on?
Hey, Ernest.
How you doing? Riley hit it on the head. It's a lot of paranoia. Here's the thing, though. You cannot empower every bus ticket seller and every passenger on an airplane with the idea that they can identify terrorists.
You can't respond to it like that. You got to respond to it. Right. You got to respond to it. If you want to send a couple of cops down, fine. You know, that's standard practice. But you can't send a squad.
You need cops in the positions to observe things. You can't have everybody calling the cops either, because you're going to run them ragged. What you got to do is, like, you had the guy from the 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement yesterday.
Yes, sir, yes.
Eric Adams, sure.
He identified the need to know. Only some people need to know, because those are the people who should be empowered to identify the terrorists. And if you have someone on an airplane, he's been screened already.
Exactly.
So you can't let a paranoid passenger suddenly, start the whole sequence like you described, where they wind up going to the captain, who then, of course, probably by protocol, will divert the plane. You know, you got to take it out of the hands of every nut.
Yeah, right. And there should be some sort of defining standard. I mean, just by protocol, because someone's uncomfortable, it wasn't a health emergency. I wonder if you're right. I'll look into that. Thanks for your call, Ernest.
Well, see, you've got a very touchy situation here. Because if someone says something and nothing's done, and God forbid that person turns out to be some kind of a terrorist, then everybody's going to say, well, why didn't anybody act on this person's suspicion? And, of course, we also see, in terms of the police, the fact that they chased a Brazilian electrician down in London and shot him 5 times in the head.
I'll tell you why you don't act, because it's impractical and it's ridiculous to act on every suspicion, isn't it? I mean, you know, if they're really buttressing themselves against that criticism, that's ridiculous, because there's no way they can accommodate that.
But remember what Tony Blair said. He said, look, had the police not acted and that guy had been some kind of a terrorist, they would have been savaged for not having acted. And that's the political response to these things.
Okay, so savage for not having acted and savage for blowing away an innocent person. I mean, you know, what is that?
Well,
I mean,
yeah, it's a bad choice, but that's the choice that politicians are now for. Remember, there was word before September 11, 2001, in August of 2001, that Osama bin Laden wanted to launch planes against U.S. targets. They ignored that, and they're catching hell for it now.
Noah, what's on your mind, Noah? How are you?
What's on my mind doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what we're talking about.
Well, then, okay.
But, no, there's a few simple things we can do. First off, the Constitution says nothing about not tagging people as they come into this country.
Tagging everybody?
Tagging every tourist, tagging everybody who comes in who's not a U.S. citizen.
Permanently tagging them, like, you know, plugging a chip into their head or what?
Yeah, I want to take a staple gun and plug a chip into their head. No, bracelets.
Yeah?
Something like that, something simple. That's the first thing. The second thing is airport security. LL checks out every passenger before they go on the plane. It's called gate security. People are waiting 2 hours to get in their flight anyway. Why can't we hire more security?
LL also has air marshals. And I think some of that stuff has been initiated. I'm not sure about the bracelet thing, because, I mean, would that be one of those rubber bracelets that says fascism on it? I don't think that might be the solution.
I don't think that's fascist. I think you're wrong about that. I think if we're protecting our country, we don't know these people. Here's another question along those same lines. You have people that are coming into this country, and we don't know who's letting them into this country from the other country.
Yeah, but how do you decide, you know, who gets a bracelet? I mean, original immigrants didn't get bracelets. I mean, you can't, you know, make everybody a suspect. It seems ridiculous.
Everybody gets a bracelet until they become a citizen.
What's your nationality?
I'm American. I'm a Jewish-born Brooklyn-American, progressive. I've been liberal my whole life. I write a liberal newsletter. I write a note from a madman. Some of you guys over there get it, I think.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Nationalview.org.
All right.
You've read my stuff. You know there's not a whole lot of people more progressive than me.
Very progressive to tag people coming into the country. I think that would create more paranoia, more anxiety, more hostility, because it doesn't seem like those tags would really mean anything. You know, we're supposed to be doing security checks. They should have a database in place. We have the technology, for Christ's sake. Why do we need bracelets if they are doing their job?
Because, like you said, we're supposed to be doing this. Hey, we were supposed to have cops on the train. It took a London bomb to get cops on trains in New York City.
But a lot of liberals don't think that they should even have that. They think that's crazy.
Hey, just because I'm a member of the ACLU doesn't mean I'm not a pragmatist.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, man. It's good talking to you, Noah.
Thanks, Noah.
He's an excitable fella. And I understand what he's saying, but you can't tag people. I mean, you can't tag people. I mean, if technology is supposed to help us and not hinder us, they should be progressing along those lines to where this stuff is effective. For the last I heard, they don't even have a terrorist database.
Well, you know, there has been talk about the possibility of having people get visas from countries that do not now require them. For example, Britain. You don't have to have a visa to come to the States from Britain.
Yeah.
You don't have to have a visa to come to the States from many other Western European countries. Maybe that's something that rather than tagging folks, make them have a visa. That way, at least there's an intermediate step before they get here.
You can fake visas. You can't fake a chip in the head. I guess you could. But look, all right, we got to go. We don't have to go. We're going to be right here, but there's some people that need to try to sell you things. So we're going to come back. We're going to do Cliff Notes, and we're going to talk about is the union going down or is it going up? We're going to find, I don't know, what's going on with the union? Is it going to help me out with this?
Sure.
All right, 49 past the hour, America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
53 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning. It's Wednesday. Let me see if I can wrap my brain around this, Riley. We're going to talk a little bit about, momentarily, about the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, has named Hillary Clinton to direct a new initiative to define a party agenda for the 2006-2008 elections. Yikes! These guys are, I'm telling you, I got, you know, there, I have some things about Hillary, against Hillary in a policy standpoint, but a lot of this stuff, it looks like Republican stuff to me, and it looks like GOP stuff to me. It looks like some serious Democratic ass kissing, and I want to talk about that in just a second. But first, let's talk about who the real core of the Democratic Party used to be and could be again if they played their cards right. Apparently, now what's happened is the union, the big union, the big one, has broken up.
That's the AFL-CIO. Yeah.
They've broken into subsidiary groups. Now, I'm trying to wrap my brain around this. Two union groups, the Teamsters and the Service Employees International Union, left the AFL-CIO on Monday.
Yeah.
The United Food and Commercial Workers and Unite Here, a group of textile and hotel workers, are weighing their options as to be part of this new group. And this new group is the Change to Win Coalition.
Yeah.
Okay. I get that. So the impact of this is it breaks up the union on the large union on one level, but on another level, it could make it more aggressive and more representative of the type of workers that are in the American environment today.
Here's the problem with unions nationally. First of all, if you go back 20 odd years, 20% of American workers were union. Now it's down to 12.5%. Some of that has to do with outsourcing. Some of that has to do with the fact that certain unions have just gone off the charts in terms of just excessive behavior. When you start looking at union bosses who are making $500,000, $600,000 a year, while the average worker is only making $25,000, you see that the whole idea of big labor is now starting to have a consequence. These guys, Andy Stern from the SEIU, who's been the catalyst for this, has been going on for a while,
right,
to talk about breaking away. This is because they want to create a new style of union. Andy Stern is not going to make $600,000, okay? That's not his thing. He's a longtime old-line student activist who's turned union activist. And his thing is, let's go organize these places in the South and other places that are in the so-called right-to-work states where union activity has been low anyway, and that's why all of those jobs have gone down there.
But let's talk about what the American workforce looks like. Apparently, the impact of breaking this thing down, there could be more union organizing. Private industries and employees in the South, where you were just talking about, where union organizing is less common, could see more union activity if splinter groups come away guys and excited about this. There could be a new style of grassroots leadership with this Change to Win coalition designed solely to organize more workers. A new style of union member, because the AFL-CIO has long been sort of like part of like heavy industries, automaking, steel.
Steel, yeah.
So now what we have, as Robert Reich has talked to us about, is, you know, we have a lot of retail workers, restaurants, janitorial workers, hotel workers, and this is where the job force is growing here. A lot of the jobs, as you said, have gone away for outsourcing. But now these jobs are seeking union representation. And this is where the Democratic Party should be focusing. But the DLC doesn't see these people as a real, you know, basis of what the Democratic Party should look like. Well, we're going to talk about that. What is your party supposed to look like? 866-303-2270. Are you part of this centrist movement we're going to talk about in a minute, but think about centrism while we go away here for a second. 57 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Call us at 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning. It's Wednesday. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark
Kayla,
Maron.
How are you doing? You all right? Good?
I'm good, buddy.
Everybody all right? You want to introduce your friend there, Kayla?
Yeah, this is Justin.
Hey, Justin.
Hey, how are you?
How are you? He's learning how to work the thing, so when you go to Rome, we have somebody here. It's nice, nice to have you.
He's a big Bon Jovi fan.
Well, everyone's got their weaknesses and their shortcomings, but I appreciate you being honest about that.
Thank you personally.
Maybe one song. All right, here's the Cliff Notes. We know I got you callers on there, 866-303-2270. We're talking a little bit about the breakup of the unions. We're going to start talking a little bit about centrist Democrats or Republicans, as I like to call them. We'll explain that in a minute. I got problems understanding this stuff. Not understanding it, but just knowing what the hell is right for the future of not just the Democratic Party, but the country and politics in general. Anyways, we'll get that in a second. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. The Space Shuttle Discovery has launched successfully. A fuel gauge problem delayed the launch 2 weeks ago. This week, the complaint was a loose wire on the CD player. This is the first time that the mission controller is a woman, meaning that this is one shuttle that will stop for directions if necessary. Democrats are calling for congressional hearings on the leak of Valerie Plame's name. Republicans have responded to this breach of national security by investigating whether Bill Clinton had oral sex in the White House. Critics point out that the only information Bill Frist wants from the White House is a firm move-in date and directions where to park the van while he unloads his stuff. President Bush might make a recess appointment for John Bolton as UN ambassador. In the time before Bolton can begin his important work at the UN, the Bush administration has been forced to use interim measures such as writing UN sucks on restroom walls and clogging the toilets. That's good. That is a good one. All right, now let's get into this. The Democratic Leadership Council. All right, this is centrist Democrats who basically had a big get together. Hillary Clinton has been put in charge of directing a new initiative to define the party agenda for 2006 and 2008. And I think this might be a little bit. This scares me because this doesn't represent what the Democratic values are really. I mean, their first thing, their four central challenges for the next decade. This is coming from the DLC. First, they have security, increasing the U.S. armed forces by 100,000 troops, require colleges to allow military recruiters on campus. That almost sounds sort of Republican to me. Am I wrong?
Well, it is.
What happened to no war? What happened to no war?
It's a rush to the center, and the power of the center can be reflected by the fact that the DLC had that big conversation thing over this past weekend, and every single person, including one person we talked to, Mark Warner, the governor of Virginia, who has aspirations for 2008, showed up. Now, have you heard of any progressive organization that has had a similar kind of meeting where everyone, Vilsack, Warner, Bayh, Clinton, where they've all showed?
No.
Exactly.
Now, yeah, and my concern, Riley, is when I listen to what's going on here and I listen to them trying to continually to fit the mold to sort of kiss up to the GOP's voting base, to the Republican voting base, and just to see that this is just politics as usual crap. These are people that are on the payroll of big corporations. They have no solution for American workers. They have no solution for, where's health care? Look at this. They got security, values, opportunity, reform. Where the hell is health care? Where is reproductive freedom? Where are some of the issues that really affect people who are working and losing their jobs in this country? Who the hell is this? Who the hell is the DLC talking to?
See, this is a central problem that came out of the 2004 election. You want health care, you want these gut bucket issues. You had a choice between Howard Dean and Dennis Kucinich. Now, people, when you look at Kucinich's platform, it should warm the cockles of every progressive's heart in this country. Yeah, he had no charisma, but so what? Jimmy Carter had less charisma than your laptop. He still got elected president.
He had a nice smile.
He was not a charismatic man. The question is, what are progressives prepared to do to elect one of their own? You can't just sit there and say, well, Kucinich is unelectable. That's not good enough. Not if you're pursuing that kind of agenda.
Well, they have to assess. All right, let's take some calls. Brian in Bloomingburg. Where are you?
I'm in the southern tip of Sullivan County, the gateway to the Borscht Belt.
Oh, okay.
Upstate New York.
Bit. What's on your mind there, Brian?
Well, I was calling to say that I think I look around here and I'm about as left wing as you can be without being in a different building.
Yeah.
I personally think that the Democratic Loser Committee there is a Trojan horse stuck in the middle of the Democratic Party to undermine it and destroy it from within.
That's
nothing but Republican light appeasers and corporatists begging for table scraps at the Republican table, and they'll never get them. Republicans will not cross the line to vote for Democrats because they're Democrats. No matter what they espouse, no matter what their positions are, and no matter how closely they align with Republicans, if a Republican voter is looking at a candidate and says, boy, he really looks like a Republican, why isn't he one?
Uh-huh.
He's not going to change his mind and vote for the Democrat because he has Republican Party plank statements in his own.
What about the independents? How will they be affected by this?
The independents are going to look at candidates who look like they should be Republicans and say, why is this person so far out of his own party's philosophy?
Right. All right. Thanks for your call, Brian. My issue here when I read this stuff about these centrist Democrats is it seems to me that what the real issue should be is how do we get people employed here properly? How do we get them health care? It seems to me that any sort of democratic values that apply to people's, you know, working lives, to their financial situation, to how they're going to be taken care of, to what this government can do for them and what they are owed by the government in terms of you know, protection and security is a personal element. It's not necessarily terrorism. It is, you know, what do I got to do to make ends meet? And how am I going to be taken care of if I don't?
That's absolutely true. But ask yourself this question. If you eliminate every potential 2008 presidential candidate who attended the DLC conversation, who you got left?
Who was there? Vilsack, Bayh,
Warner,
Hillary Clinton.
Who else?
Who else was there? I don't have any reason.
Who else is left?
I don't know, right?
That's exactly the point.
Well, I'm hoping
DLC knows, and until progressives get behind one person and say, you know what, we're going to make this. I don't care how long, he could be as uncharismatic as that door.
Uh-huh.
But if he's got the right policies, you put the right people around him. George Bush wasn't oozing charisma. The bottom line is you've got to decide that these are your principles, these are your values, and that's your vessel.
And you have to, right, and you have to shove them down the throat and the brains of the people that will vote for you and make them believe them through repetition. Whether or not they will really honor what they say or whether or not they will really help people, you know, that doesn't happen until afterwards. And 90% of the time, it doesn't.
Well, 90% of the time, it doesn't. But remember something. Dennis Kucinich represents a district of 587,000 people. That's what every congressional district in the United States is now pegged at. He's managed to convince the majority of people in that area that he's got their interests at heart. The challenge is to expand that.
Yeah, let's take one more call. Hey, Tom, what's going on, Tom, in Chicago? How are you?
Very good.
What's on your mind?
You were bringing up some things earlier about why everything's gone sour for unions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What does the Democratic Party need to do? I think what our biggest problem that has happened over the last couple decades is deregulation.
Okay.
Our union can't exist in a deregulated economy. It's like sliding at snowflakes. You organize something and then they shut the doors on you and open up down the street under a different name. That's
right.
Part of what goes on. Now, the other part is, unregulated competition evolves into combination, forms a monopoly, economic dictatorship. You end up with a handful of corporations controlling everything, including the government.
That's
the direction we're moving in.
Yeah.
Some people call that fascism. The opposite extreme is raw socialism, and nothing works. There's no incentives to get anything done.
Okay.
Now, what we need to do is we need to re-regulate, but the problem is we can't sell it. And there's one area we can sell it in. For example, they get rid of the Interstate Commerce Commission. We've deregulated public utilities. We've deregulated transportation. We've deregulated communications.
And it's a disaster in some ways.
It is, because you got too much control in the hands of a few.
And also you're paying six phone bills. You're paying for your water. You're getting, you're rolling blackouts and brownouts in Los Angeles and California area because of competition. It's a disaster for regular people.
See, now, what I'm pointing at is the one place that can be, that you can get the body politic to follow you on is healthcare.
Yes.
It's never been regulated. It screams for regulation. It needs rate of return regulation.
Okay.
Yeah, it's interesting.
AT&T for many years was the largest regulated monopoly in the world, and it actually worked. They were regulated at the cost of capital, which at the time was 6%. They told them flat out, if you make more than 6% profit or pay more than 6% in dividends, we'll force you to cut the phone rates.
Uh-huh.
Well, every time they saw they could make more than 6%, which was every year, they'd spend the money. R&D, Bell Labs, new technology, new products, new services, Western Electric, space program, you name it, they got in it. Instead of making 6% in a small capital base, they made it on a huge capital base. They made thousands of times the profits. It was never usurious.
Yeah.
Worked everyone's benefit, created all kinds of jobs, steady, stable growth, a technological revolution. We passed everyone up.
So, Tom... Well, do you think
when they broke them up, the first thing they did was shut down Western Electric, lay off 30,000 people overnight, and have the Taiwanese make the phones because labor costs were cheaper, and now they were free to maximize profit.
Right.
So we've been feeding off our assets ever since, and shipping our jobs overseas, all for greed because we didn't regulate it anymore.
So do you think then that, you know, just getting back to the issue of the of how the Democrats you know reach out to these people and change some of these by re-regulation and also by do you think that health care should be their number one priority and they should build around that?
I think that healthcare is the one of the main. What, as far as healthcare is concerned, I think they'd be screaming in Congress for a healthcare commission, appointed by Congress, not by the president.
Right. Okay.
And because you know Congress runs the country, not the president. Under our Constitution, we just don't do it.
So we got to get active. You know, I think I have a feeling we could talk forever. You're a very informed guy, and I appreciate your call, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah, he made some very, very interesting points.
Well, they're very interesting points because this is not what the DLC is about. This is not, you know, he's talking, you know, in a very nuanced way about why American workers are screwed. And why, you know, we're in the situation we're in. And now if this thing about re-regulation is true, that which is, you know, I think it's a very good idea, but I doubt that given the legislation that this administration, that Republicans fight for and pass, it's almost impossible right now.
Well, yeah, you want to throw a challenge at the DLC? Tell them, look, you want employers to pick up the cost of health care for more workers so that Medicaid doesn't go down the tubes in the next 20 years.
All right, it's 18 past the hour. It's been very engaging here. You know, some good calls. We're going to, in a minute, we're going to find out what is the true profile of a suicide bomber. You're going to be surprised. It's 18 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Some lively conversation, man.
Oh, yeah.
We had some good callers, some very exciting stuff. I'm looking forward to talking to our guest in a few minutes. He's a professor. He knows what he's talking about. You know, professors are interesting. It's their job to think and assess. I'd like to have that job. It's kind of my job, but I don't have any credentials, Riley.
Need credentials for that.
You know, don't you need credentials to think and assess things? You do, don't you?
Of course
you?
Not.
Come on.
I don't have any credentials. I think and assess stuff all the time.
All right, let's do this. Let's talk about suicide bombers. Our guest is going to be Robert Pape, and he has a book called Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, which is it really will shed some light on why they do what they do. There are some things in it that I didn't realize. And it's interesting, in talking about the London attacks of July 7th, that Mark Riley called this thing, you know, like days after it happened. He said that they might not have known they were suicide bombers, and now there is speculation that the bombers on July 7th might not have known they were going to blow up. And there's a few reasons, and you cited them almost immediately after the attack. Each one of the four guys had purchased round-trip railway tickets.
From Luton to London, yeah.
One rented a car that had a 7-day parking sticker on the dash.
That would be Jermaine Lindsay, the Jamaican guy.
A large quantity of explosives were stored in the trunk of that car. No one left a note or a video or a web statement, which is common for these suicide bombers, a manifesto statement of sorts, a jihadist type of statement. One guy had a kid and a family, and they'd all visited relatives. One theory holds that they knew the bombs had timers on them. They were instructed to stay with the bombs until they left the bombs at 9, and that the bombs were going to go off at 9:10, and the timers were rigged by whoever made the bombs.
To go off 10 minutes earlier.
To go off 10 minutes earlier. Wow, if that's the case, do you even call these guys suicide bombers, or were they homicide victims of that?
Stupid dupes is what they are.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't call them victims. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely stupid dupes that were part of a larger agenda. And now, you know, New York NYPD has sent their bomb specialist over to London to investigate the bombs, because these bombs were, this is one of the great threats in suicide bombing, is that a lot of these bombs are crude, they're unstable explosives, they're made from stuff you can buy from chemical warehouses. Mm-hmm. These bombs were made that way, and apparently they put some research and investigation into if anyone's made purchases of some of these chemicals in the bombs that were used in London. It was acetone, acid, and peroxide.
TATP.
Uh-huh. And so, this is pretty easy stuff. But, in terms of making bombs, it's weird that you know what the ingredients are. That was my first reaction. It's like, wow, if they're just putting this in the paper,
yeah.
I imagine you wouldn't have to look too far to find out the exact recipe.
Well, it's funny. The British are now trying to criminalize people trying to get these kinds of bomb-making recipes off the Internet. There is a bill that's being considered in the Parliament that would make that a crime. So you're looking at folks that are trying to speak to these issues. But the fact is that, when it comes to explosives, anyone that's taken a chemistry class in high school knows that there are different materials that you can use with varying degrees of volatility, varying degrees of safety, but if you put them together, they'll blow something up.
And the weird thing about, and the horrible thing about suicide bombers is that if they are suicide bombers and that's what they're going to do, there's really no way. You're not going to talk them out of it.
No.
And the frightening thing about many suicide bombers is a lot of them have no criminal history. A lot of them have no prior religious affiliation. A lot of them are just sort of walk-in customers who make a decision. And they walk into these places that need suicide bombers, these evil institutions, and they say, I'm ready to do what's necessary. Like Muhammad Atta apparently had no criminal history.
Yeah.
He was not really a religious person. Said, I want to be part of this and I'm willing to die for it. And this is a unique type of psychology, unique type of personality. And it's not always specifically about jihad. Our guest, Robert Pape, is going to talk to us in a moment. He's the author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. And we're going to get to the bottom of something, or at least, give you a newer profile on what a suicide bomb really is. It's 27 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It is 34 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
Terra America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Man, if you only knew what we talked about on the break. Hey, we're in just a minute. We're going to have a conversation with Robert Pape. He's the author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. But first, I'd like to hear this Scott McClellan. This is a White House spokesperson, Scott McClellan, talking about the nature of suicide bombers. He's a reporter asking Scott McClellan about the bombers' connection to Islam. This is in relation to the bombings in London.
Terrorists commit acts supposedly in the name of Allah. Does President Bush think that's the same as using the term God?
Those who carry out such attacks are not religious people. Islam is a religion that teaches peace. Islam is a religion that the president has spoken about at length, particularly in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. Those who seek to hijack it to spread their hateful ideology don't represent a great faith like Islam.
That was Scott McClellan. That was on July 13th. Suicide bombers continue to attack in Iraq and, as we've seen recently, in London and in Egypt. Is Islamic fundamentalism driving these attacks, and how do we stop them? Joining us now by phone is the author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. He's also a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Good morning, Robert Pape. How are you?
Very good.
Good morning.
So now you heard, perhaps you heard on the phone there what Scott McClellan is saying. Why do you say that fundamentalism does not necessarily motivate suicide bombers? And that's what everyone has said does. That's the common conception.
I've studied 462 suicide terrorists from around the world since 1980.
Okay.
And in fact, that's the complete set from 1980 to early 2004. Over half are secular. The world leader in suicide terrorism is the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. They're a Marxist group that's completely secular, a Hindu group. Even among Muslims, over one-third are Muslim groups that are completely secular.
So is it
like
a
PKK in Turkey?
Is it a personal desire? Is it tied to some sort of what is the politics then of suicide bombers? Why are they doing it?
Over 95% of suicide terrorist attacks from around the world since 1980 have in common not religion, but are driven by a specific strategic motive: to drive modern democracies with military forces on territory that the terrorists care about, to take those forces out. From Lebanon to Sri Lanka to Kashmir to Chechnya to the West Bank, every suicide terrorist campaign since 1980 has had as its central objective to compel a democratic state to withdraw combat forces, I don't mean advisors, combat forces from territory that the terrorists prize.
So in terms of recruiting and in terms of these particular personalities having the psychology to do this, do you find any commonality among that, the pathology of the bombers themselves?
I've studied this quite carefully, and there are a variety of specific personal circumstances that make up a suicide terrorist. Some are clearly doing it for social prestige. They make the martyr videos, trying to get a prestige from their community after their death. Some had family members killed or abused by occupation forces. Some are religious. There's actually a wide variety of personal experiences that recruiters can play on, but what unifies across all is deep anger at the presence of foreign combat troops on territory that the terrorists prize. Absent that anger over foreign troops, there's really quite little evidence that these individuals would do a suicide terrorist act or commit suicide anyway.
Robert Pape, we've seen recently incidents where Muslims have attacked other Muslims. In fact, in the London situation, one of the bombs went off at a train station that serves a predominantly Muslim neighborhood. Does fundamentalism, in your judgment, provide any rationale for Muslims killing Muslims, this whole Takfir movement that people talk about?
And in fact, the it doesn't. And in fact, specifically religious attackers and the terrorist groups that are more religious often are wholly embarrassed and often in trouble when they kill other Muslims. And the fact is, if this were just an evil ideology, that would never happen. They would go to great lengths never to kill another Muslim. The fact is, they're quite willing to have that quote-unquote collateral damage occur because that's a side effect of their real aim. Their actual aim is to focus on killing members of the target society so that that will put pressure on the target government to change its policies.
In today's Washington Post, David Ignatius called the London bombings a Muslim revolt of privilege, a far more deadly version of Patty Hearst or the Weather Underground, which to me seems ridiculous. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I haven't really read what he's had to say on that, so I just don't want to really comment on that directly. What I would just simply say is repeat that what's happening here is that suicide terrorism is different than ordinary terrorism, and it has in common a very specific pattern across the world. And sometimes it does look more secular, sometimes it's more religious, sometimes it's more a function of how heavy-handed occupation forces are. But the fact is there is a deep commonality. It's a bit like lung cancer. There's multiple causes for lung cancer, but there's one thing that stands out above all else, which is smoking cigarettes. And that's very similar here with suicide terrorism.
So how are you characterizing the other terrorism?
Well, it's ordinary terrorism. They don't kill themselves. I mean, when you're committing acts where you're killing others or threatening others but don't kill yourself, that doesn't require anywhere near the level of deep commitment by the individual. And in fact, we often see criminals doing it. We often see people who are do-gooders doing it. We see a different variety there. But what, of course, we don't see is they kill themselves. So what's different about a suicide terrorist act is that it's not that they're preferring to kill themselves. After all, if they were, they could easily do that without killing others. It's that they're willing to kill themselves to maximize the number that they are able to kill in their attack. And that really does seem to be occurring at least 95% of the time in a very specific circumstance It's less about the individual motive, although everybody, of course, is fan, you know, they're very interested in that, than the specific circumstances in which individuals can be more easily recruited than we'd like to believe.
Well, Robert Pape, the author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, then what you're saying is something that, you know, there is a, I guess, what is almost a, it's just misinformation that a lot of people believe these guys all think they're going to heaven and they're going to get 72 virgins. And the picture you're portraying, you're painting, is that, you know, many of them have, it has nothing to do with a heavenly payoff or not even necessarily martyrdom.
Well, I'm not saying there's zero effect there, but this is, again, like lung cancer. In the 1960s, we had no comparative studies of lung cancer. In fact, we had companies telling us, oh, cigarette smoking has nothing to do with lung cancer. Well, the fact is that we're in a similar situation today. I'm not so much saying people are lying or there's misinformation. It's just that if we don't really study global patterns of suicide terrorism, we're not going to be able to understand what is the central cause driving it, and we can easily make matters worse. And what's happened, this is a lot, as I say, like lung cancer, whereas until we actually did the scientific comparative studies of lung cancer, it was not clear that there was one central factor that stood head and shoulders above the rest. Cigarette smoking, and it took a comparative study. And I know many people don't really want to think about Sri Lanka. I don't want to think about Sri Lanka, but the fact is, if you don't study where it is and where it isn't happening, we can't really see what makes the pivotal difference.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
Robert Pape, you addressed the Out of Iraq caucus just yesterday. What did you tell them about how, if this is not religious, how do you stop it short of changing the policy, which is what happened in Madrid?
Well, I was actually honored to be on Capitol Hill for two times now in a month. First, a month ago, to speak to a predominantly Republican forum, and now to a predominantly Democratic forum. And in both cases, I laid out the basic patterns of global suicide terrorism, which from my research, which does not exist in any other form, even in our government. They were quite interested, and I suggested that we consider a policy not that makes concessions to the terrorists, that would be a mistake, and not that simply tries to stick it in their eye, but we focus on what is our vital interest in the Persian Gulf, which is access to oil, and we consider an alternative strategy to our current one, the current one being onshore combat presence. The alternative is offshore balancing, the strategy we pursued for decades before 1990. In the 1970s and 80s, we secured our interest in oil with forces poised to be at the ready to go on the Arabian Peninsula, but not actually stationed on it. We didn't station a single combat soldier on the Arabian Peninsula during that period, and that strategy works splendidly.
Now, you're talking about troop ships and that sort of thing? You're talking about ships off the coast of the Persian?
More specifically, we had an alliance with Iraq and Saudi Arabia, which we can do again. We had aircraft carriers off the coast so we could use air power rapidly, and air power is much more powerful today than it was 30 years ago. And then we had bases on the Arabian Peninsula without combat troops or tanks or fighter aircraft, but we had bases so that we could rapidly deploy thousands of combat forces rapidly in a crisis, which is what we did in August 1990, and that reversed Saddam Hussein's aggression against. That was an excellent strategy, and it's something we can easily two or three year period, and the first step to doing that is over the next 12 months completely transferring responsibility for the security of Iraq to the Iraqi government, including letting the Iraqi government build its own army.
And again, to pull out of there?
That business.
And to pull out of there altogether, take all the bases out of Iraq and all the troops.
No, we don't necessarily have to pull out. I'm not saying leave in, all our troops out in one year, maybe over 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm also not saying we can't even have any bases there. We can't have any combat troops there. That's the issue here is much more precisely tanks, fighter aircraft, combat troops. Just having bases, concrete on the ground, buildings that are supported by the local government, we can even probably help pay for those. That's really not the pivotal factor that the terrorist leaders use to recruit. What you see in the research that I've done is that the terrorist leaders focus like a laser light on the presence of our foreign forces on the Arabian Peninsula. And yes, they say many other things, but it's that pivotal factor of the presence of tanks, fighter aircraft, doing combat operation after combat operation that they depict in their appeals. The Al-Qaeda group that claimed responsibility just 2 hours after the first London attacks said specifically this was to punish Britain for British military operations in Iraq. They're doing that to recruit others
gotcha.
For a similar purpose.
All right, Professor Papas, great talking to you. I'm still sort of baffled why the government didn't have a reasonable and effective survey of suicide bombing, and I appreciate you you finally doing it. It was one of those things where you'd think that they would have some of that research. So if anybody wants that research, they can find it in your book, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. It's very informative talking to you. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate myself.
Okay, take care. 47 past the hour. I think Future Mark might be calling. I'm not sure. Stay with us for that. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it. Eat it.
On Air America Radio.
One past the hour at Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Dude, they found a 28,000-year-old penis, and I don't want to get into it too much.
Right? But I'm sure you don't.
They found
a
28,000-year-old penis. How do you like that? Huh? How do you like that? What?
Mark.
What?
Future Mark is on line one.
I'll explain it later. Future Mark, great. Put that guy through. I love that guy. Hey, buddy.
Hey,
what's
buddy,
up?
What's up?
So, Future Mark, what's going on in 2050? What was that?
I'm having a car chase, Mark. Hold on.
Who are you chasing?
My clone.
Oh, man. What did you do to him?
All right. I smacked him around a little. He was mouthing off in that, you know, silent way that really pisses me off. You know, he kind of gave me that look, which isn't really a look, but it is.
All right, so basically your clone didn't deserve it.
Well, afterwards, the little baby just stormed out and took my car. Hold on, I gotta pass this guy. He's going for a tunnel up here. I'm following him. What the hell is this place?
What's going on, man?
It's like this underground cavern, and there are all these Humvees with gun mounts. Wow, there's a printing press. A giant bank of computers?
Yeah.
Hey, you remember the James Bond movies? Remember where Dr. No used to live?
Yeah, I think so.
Dude, this is totally a lair.
Intruder, in the name of the Clone Revolution Army, who goes there?
Future Mark Riley? What the hell are you doing here?
Oh, hey, Future Mark Maron, what's up, man?
Future Mark Riley?
Yes, it's weird, and he's pointing a double-barrel percussion blaster at me. Future Mark Riley, what is this place?
More importantly, how did you find this place? This lair is for clones only.
I follow my clone here.
What's going on? Why does Future Mark Riley have a clone-only lair?
The mistreatment of the clones has gone on far too long. Clones are people, too.
Yeah. You're right, clones are people.
In fact, I've created my own clone army down here to make sure clones don't take any more crap from the man.
Wow.
Say hello, fellas.
Morning. What are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah, what are you doing here?
Oh, my God. There are hundreds of you.
Wait. Hundreds of Rileys?
Yeah.
That's cool.
You know what? It's actually not cool. They're all armed, and I'm a little nervous in here.
I asked you once already, what are you doing here?
Well, let's see. My clone was a little sad, so I wanted to follow him to cheer him up and give him a present.
Is that what really happened, Future Mark Clone?
No. He beat me again, and he yelled at me and called me stupid.
Uh-oh, man. You better get out of there.
See, Mark? You're either part of the problem or part of the solution. We will stop clone abuse by any means necessary, and we'll start with you.
Future Mark Riley for saving me.
You'll be safe here, my brother.
Hey, Future Mark Riley, are you there?
Is this past Mark Maron? Because I almost had to put my foot in Future Mark Maron's ass.
Yeah, Future Mark Riley. I was wondering if you had any advice for me from the future.
Yeah, eat more pie.
Pie? You mean like dessert pie?
Yeah, pie. It goes out of style. You should eat all the pie you can now.
Yeah, pie.
Well, I gotta go start the revolution. Pass Mark, power to the clones.
Okay, man. See ya. Oh man.
Lord.
So there you are, Riley. You're there
I'm
too.
I'm in the future.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I didn't go to hell like everyone said.
No, I don't know. That's, I mean, who knows where we are? You know, I'm surprised. Hopefully someday, maybe I don't know. Maybe space. Huh?
I don't know. Was this the same cave where the phallus was uncovered?
That's a good question. A sculpted and polished phallus found in a German cave is among the earliest representations of male sexuality ever uncovered. A 28,000-year-old. That's right. It was found in the Hohlfels cave near Ulm. The prehistoric tool. Not my words. That's actually in the copy. It was in the story, and it was in quotation marks. Do they have a sense of humor at the newspaper?
I guess they must. It's the BBC.
The prehistoric tool was assembled from 14 fragments of siltstone. Its size may indicate it was used as a sex aid by ice age makers, say scientists. How do you like that, Riley?
Ice age what?
This is a Paleolithic dildo.
Either that or an ancient strap-on.
But I don't know. I didn't look at a picture of it. Did it look like it had buckles and hinges on the side?
I didn't. The copy I have doesn't have a picture, but I did see it before I.
Well, maybe it fit into some sort of ancient harness of some kind. Yeah, sure. I know what I'm talking about. It was probably a symbolic. You know, do we talk about? No, I'm not going to.
It was highly polished. I know that.
I'm not censored. All right. Well, look.
Yeah.
The strap-on thing, sometimes my wife says that to me. She's like, why don't we? And I'm like, because I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why. I'm a little nervous, right. It makes me, what?
She wants to put it on you?
No. The other way.
Also, she wants to put it on herself.
Yeah. Yeah. How would you feel about that, Kayla?
With your wife?
No. No, with your mother. What are you talking about?
Wow.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
I used to love the fat guy.
All right, we'll pull it out of the toilet here in a minute.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Talk about the issues.
57 past the hour. We're going to come back. Alberto Gonzalez has got a problem. It's a 12-hour problem, and I hope we can exploit that 12 hours for as much as possible. So we'll talk about that in a second. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 past the hour. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens. You're listening to Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
How you doing, Mark Riley?
I'm doing great.
How you doing, Kalo?
I'm great.
You're better now. You got a face full of donuts.
Yeah, baby.
Boy, man. I tell you, the show we have in here on the break is filthy.
Yeah.
Woo,
but we wiped it off.
Yes, we did. The shuttle blasted off with its crew of seven yesterday in a beautiful launch. And I got to say, not a big space guy, not a big science fiction guy, not a guy that was that curious about space. I thought it was pretty cool, man. I thought it was great to see. I love that wing camera. To see that thing move away from the ground.
Yeah.
You would go on it, wouldn't you, Riley?
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Wait for me.
My wife, that's the kind of thing she looks at and goes, we got to get one of those. We got to get on a shuttle. She loves things that goes fast. And apparently Virgin Airlines or Branson.
Richard Branson.
He's building something. He's already taking reservations to flying little mini shuttles to fly around in space.
Yeah, I know. How much is he charging? What is it, $20,000 a pop or something?
It was expensive. But, I mean, if my question is, if they still have problems with this shuttle, I mean, how is he going to get the thing up off the ground?
Private industry.
I guess so. Maybe they can actually afford to update it. Now, apparently, one of the problems with this shuttle is it's from 1981, and they don't have the money to build a bigger, better shuttle. This one has 2 million working parts, 300 miles of wire in it.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Well, you know,
300 miles of wire.
Bush has said that they're going to retire these three, because there are three in the current series of shuttles. They'll be retired in 2010. They're still going to fly more missions between now and 2010. But they are going to be retired, and I assume, if the money's right, that they will build a new generation.
Right. This was the first shuttle blast off in 2.5 years. They spent that time. They made about 50 safety improvements, and a new fuel tank was completely redesigned after the Columbia shuttle. But people at NASA still say that this thing has fundamental problems that can't be fixed just because it's outdated. In 113 missions, the shuttle has been hit with debris about 15,000 times, mostly at liftoff.
Wow.
And there was some of that yesterday, but they said that it doesn't seem like a problem. And when they're up there, they're going to be experimenting with ways to actually fix the shuttle in flight if something does crack or something goes wrong. They've got goo and paste and caulking guns, and they're going to be doing some experiments to see if they can pull it off. It's not clear whether, if something really did go wrong, whether they could pull it off, but they have in the lab. Who knows if they can do it in space?
Hopefully we'll find out.
Hopefully they won't have to, but they will make some tests. Now, George Pataki, our governor here in New York State, has decided not to run for governor again. Does that mean he's going to run for president, Riley?
It may mean he's going to run for president. He's not going to come out and say it. He is scheduled. Now, there was a meeting that he held last night. Apparently, people from all over the state had to scramble to get there. And it is from this meeting, which was an off-the-record meeting, that sources are saying he's going to announce today that he's actually going to not run for a fourth term. He went out to Iowa. I think he tested the waters. If he's smart, that'll be as far as he goes with this thing.
Yeah.
He'll look for an ambassadorship or perhaps, a commissioner's job or a secretary's job, in someone else's cabinet, assuming a Republican gets elected.
Right. Why wouldn't he just retire? I mean, what is that? I mean, I got to be honest with you. I don't know nothing about this guy. What kind of guy is he? Is he a rich guy? Does he have a lot of dough? Where's he come from?
He comes from not that far upstate. He's got a horse farm, I believe, in Garrison,
uh-huh,
which is, I think, like maybe 100-odd miles
outside.
Where'd
he make his money?
That's an interesting question. He is, I believe, just essentially a horse farmer and politician.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Because I find him difficult to look at. I find him boring. I think he's sort of a bootlicker, isn't he?
Well, see, Pataki came out of nowhere. Nobody knew. In 1994, when he ran for governor, nobody knew who this guy was. Mm. He was a wholly owned creation of then-Senator Al D'Amato.
Mm-hmm.
He managed to stun the world and beat Mario Cuomo, who people had been touting for president just 2 years earlier.
Yeah, I like Cuomo.
Yeah, well, yeah. He got beat by Pataki. He got beat badly. Mm. And a lot of that had to do with Pataki saying that he would sign a death penalty bill, which he did in 1995 as soon as he got into office. And guess how many people have been executed since
then?
Absolutely none.
That's good news. Frank Lautenberg, who's been on our show many times, Senator Frank Lautenberg from New Jersey, that would be to you, and 26 Democrats, Democratic senators, that would be,
yeah,
are holding a press conference today and have signed on to a letter. When is it?
I think it might have been yesterday.
Oh, okay. But 26 Democratic senators have held a press conference and signed on to a letter authored by John Kerry calling for hearings for Congress to investigate the leaking of covert CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity. They are irritated, to say the least, and not one hearing has been held on the matter. And this is the Lautenberg flair. Lautenberg is concerned specifically with the role of Alberto Gonzalez and the missing 12 hours, which I'll explain in a second. And the release for this, for the 4:30 meeting yesterday, as you're reporting there, Riley, was what went on between 8 p.m. and AA at 8 a.m. They will also unveil what they call a web calendar, noting it has been 742 days since the Plame outing without a single hearing held in Congress. Now, the 12 hours in question was when Alberto Gonzalez was special counsel to the White House.
Yes.
Before he was attorney general, he was alerted by the Justice Department, by Ashcroft's Justice Department, that the CIA had initiated a grand jury investigation into the leak of Plame's name. So they called, the Justice Department calls Alberto Gonzalez. Alberto Gonzalez tells who? Nobody. For 12 hours, except Andrew Card, chief of staff, which gave him plenty of time to start shredding, to start making plans, to start obfuscating, to start figuring out ways to displace Plame and move things around. That's my supposition. Whether or not the grand jury will find that to be true, I don't know, but this is just another element in the puzzle, and the stink is so thick on this administration right now that they can't even find any friends to support where they're coming from, and they've run out of people to crap on as well.
Well, Alberto Gonzalez has come up with what seems to be a very innocuous reason for not sharing this information with anybody. He said he got it at 8 o'clock at night. It was late. People had gone home. The problem here for him is the question of whether or not his actions in that 12-hour gap in any way hindered the investigation. Did they shred documents? Did they let people know who might potentially be targets of an investigation so they could shred documents? Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, did Gonzalez give people in the White House time to get their story straight? They must have known sooner or later that certain people were going to be drawn into this. They might not have known at the time it was going to be Karl Rove. They might not have known it was going to be Scooter Libby. They probably didn't know it was going to be Tim Russert. All of these people have testified in front of this grand jury, and it looks like Alberto Gonzalez turned out to be the gatekeeper here.
Yeah, and this is like it's really unfolding into a cover-up, into some, you know, conspiracy charges. There's obviously perjury charges. This administration is guilty of treason, though I think that, you know, would be hard to prosecute. He should be impeached, Bush, and the fact that he's distanced himself from, he hasn't distanced himself from Roe, but he refuses to take any action as president, as the boss of this neocon death cult, this cabal that has taken over the White House and is actually at war with the CIA, which is what a lot of this is coming from, is that the CIA has been gutted and blamed for you know, the information that was bullied out of them by the neocon death cult, and now they're getting their payback, and now I think that justice might be served a bit if there are some perjury charges handed out.
See, we're at a point now where to think or suggest that the President of the United States does not know who in his inner circle was involved in this leak would be malfeasance. I mean, it would be like the equivalent of medical malpractice for a doctor. There's no way in the world Bush doesn't know who did this. He knows whether it was Libby. He knows whether it was Rove. He knows if it was both of them. He knows if Alberto Gonzalez hindered this inquiry. The thing is, he's holding it under the vest. And to me, that is the definition of a high crime and misdemeanor.
It's very exciting stuff. It's very exciting stuff that this guy, that this administration is being discredited so publicly and unable to really protect itself. It's about damn time. That's all I say.
No,
I mean, I really believe that. I mean, these guys have gotten away with murder, with thievery, with, you know, gross, high crimes and misdemeanors, impeachable offenses.
Yeah. Well, see, it may end up coming down to that. Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury is not going to draw up articles of impeachment against George W. Bush, but it could start the process that would end up, if not with articles of impeachment, certainly with a lame duck president who cannot function until 2008.
Okay, so look, you know, here in New York, as we've been reporting the last few days, there's been some, you know, there's been some searching going on in the trains. There's been some panic. There's been some investigations going into, you know, chemical sales. There's been a lot of things going on, and city transit officials have gone to Washington because they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something they really prepared for, and it's sort of sad. And it's sort of interesting, and we're going to talk about it in just a couple minutes. It is now 16 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio with Mark and Mark.
Hi, this is Mark Maron's mom, and you're listening to my son and his friend Mark Riley. They're very good boys. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yeah,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program, and we're doing it here. Look, folks, you're gonna have an opportunity to see how comedy is developed. How exciting is that gonna be? You know, on this show we have several characters that we use. We have Lawton Smalls. We have Pendejo.
Yeah.
We have the Milfington series.
Well, yeah, the triplets, I think.
The whole Milfington family. many of the writers do characters. You hear characters. We have Johnny K. Street.
Yes.
You hear characters in the Morning Sedition Radio Theater. But one of our writers doesn't have a character. And that's Little Bruce Cherry.
Little Bruce
Cherry is going to come in here, and we want you to be part of this. He's going to come in and pitch an idea for a character he's got to bring on the show. And we're going to do it live. I'm very excited to hear the pitch, and we're going to want you to call and give us some feedback on the pitch. And maybe over a series of time, like if this turns out to be funny and Bruce is actually effective, we'll be able to make a choice of which character Bruce can do here on the show.
Bruce actually effective? Is that what you said?
No, Bruce. You know, Bruce is a very funny man.
I know.
I remember back in, I think it was in the early 70s when Bruce started doing stand-up. he was extremely funny.
He's going to be in here before the next segment.
Let's talk about this. Here in New York, we have had some discussion about police searches, that whole thing sort of blew up with that Gray Line bus, the double-decker bus where the guy from the Gray Line calls and tells her
there's a woman.
A woman who calls and says, boy, I'm just getting my facts all left and right today. Calls up the police, says there's some five guys acting suspicious. That squad comes on the bus with guns drawn, pulls everyone off the bus, gets these guys on the ground, cuffs them, and then lets them go. It's just horrendous. We can't have people that just are able to do that. But it does go to show you that in a lot of ways, we are not really prepared or do we have any standards in place, by which we can do this with any grace whatsoever. If this is going to be an ongoing threat or God forbid something happens here. Now, the NYPD has sent, they sent some transit aides, some top transit security officials from New York City, Los Angeles, and Washington, went to Washington. And told a House panel on Tuesday that more federal money was not their only need in terms of securing their cities, but they don't know what to do. They're like, can you help us out? Can you give us some standards? And we were talking about this earlier. The Homeland Security, one of their jobs should be to set some standards in terms of what people should be equipping themselves with, where they should be getting it, what stuff isn't just a bunch of hucksters selling crap, and also suggest some methods of how to deal with some of the threats that that people are trying to process right now.
Well, it's interesting. Benny Thompson, who we've talked to, a Democratic congressman from Mississippi, who's on the Homeland Security Committee, says that the Department of Homeland Security is late in delivering a federal plan that is supposed to be in place to deal with the nation's various transit systems. So it looks as though the plan that, when Los Angeles and New York and Washington say, well, we don't know what to do, they're not saying that in a vacuum. They were supposed to be told, and they weren't.
Yeah. It's all very, we assume sort of, obviously here at this show, we assume a certain amount of disorganization, a certain amount of distrust. We were talking about that earlier. Kalo and I were talking about it off air, is that you got people on an airplane. You got these three Pakistani guys who are on an airplane. Two of them are sitting in first class, one sitting in coach. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's it. The airplane's going from Los Angeles to London. Okay? Some people on the plane see this guy, the guy going up to coach, up from coach to first class, the guys from first class coming back to coach, back and forth to talk to each other. Customers, flyers, people on the plane start freaking out. Tell the stewardess, I think there's something weird going on. These guys keep running around. All right? So the stewardess freaks out, goes and tells the captain. Yeah. I don't know. We've got three guys. They look Arab. They're acting weird. They're making people uncomfortable. So the pilot looks for landing clearance. They put the plane down, pull these guys off, question them, release them, send them on another flight back to England. They were guilty of nothing. Now, my point is that there is such a fundamental distrust on behalf of everyone about how secure we are on any level. I mean, the airport, you got to go through security for 2 hours. You would think that there was some effectiveness. We know that it's not always effective, but the odds of someone getting on the plane with a bomb or a box cutter, like the 9/11 guys, that wouldn't even be effective. They have locks on the captain's doors now, on the cockpit doors. I just think it's crazy that we cannot have people just pointing and having people strung up.
But see, the flip side of that, Mark, is that people are being encouraged to, if you see something suspicious, report it to somebody.
A culture of rats.
Yeah, a culture of paranoia. And, you've got to be able at some point to balance people's legitimate fears with the idea that you can't just go pointing at people. This incident in New York with the Sikhs, the incident on the plane, the incident in Egypt where they detained five Pakistanis and God knows what they did to them, and then let them go and said they had nothing to do with the Sharm el-Sheikh bombing.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Is the one thing that, we can say that we've made some progress is the three Pakistanis who were suspicious on the plane, who were sent to London on another plane. I mean,
they weren't rendition.
Exactly. They weren't sent on a CIA plane to Egypt or Jordan. So they must be really clean, or else we've made some progress in identifying these guys. And also, what is the real solution? I mean, apparently the MTA here, investigators are keeping a secret database of people stopped and questioned for filming or photographing bridges and tunnels and reservoirs. This is in order to stop terror. Are they just just vacation shots of a reservoir in a subway, or are they actually plotting? I mean, in some cases the film is kept, in other cases the film, in all cases it's reviewed, and a database, I guess, would be plugged into some sort of technology which hasn't revealed itself that could match, you know, suspects with terror suspect lists, with mug shots, and that can be all happen in real time. But it seems to me that we're way far away from that.
Well, we are, and you know, when you talk about people photographing stuff in New York, you're talking about tens of thousands of people. People go up on the Brooklyn Bridge and photograph every day.
Yeah,
what they're shooting, I don't know.
But, you know, I'm just wondering if there are suspected terrorists who are plotting that actually put their friends in. This is him at another subway stop. Anyways, Bruce Cherry's coming up. Get ready to call us to see what you think of his comedy pitch. He's going to come in here and pitch a character that he wants to do on the show. 866-303-2270 is our number. I'm looking forward to this. I like Bruce, and him and I have a strange relationship. It's 27 past the hour, America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Yeah, 34 past the hour. It's Wednesday. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
I'm asleep.
Are you? Well, see, we shouldn't eat the donuts. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I feel all right. I'm going to ride this out. I'm going to ride the donut buzz out. You got to go stuff some more in your face, Riley. You got to stuff some more donuts in your face. Oh, get up.
Oh,
in a minute, we're going to talk about Michael Bloomberg, who's getting a lot of support from rich Democrats. I think one of the reasons is they don't have to put any money into the
pot.
That's
right.
But right now, we're going to do something interesting. Get ready to call because we're going to need some feedback on this pitch. 866-303-2270 is our number. And as you know, our writers come on the show to perform as some of our regular characters. All of our writers have at least one character they come on the show to do. All of our writers except for Bruce Cherry. Can I say little Bruce Cherry? Who, while very funny, has yet to come up with a character that can become a regular on Morning Sedition. This bothers Bruce. Stop tapping your fingers, Bruce. This bothers Bruce a little bit and makes him a little paranoid. So in the interest of making Bruce feel more comfortable, every week Bruce is going to come in here into the studio to pitch live to us. A character piece that just might make it into the regular rotation is what we're looking for. And we have to, you know, like it, of course, and we'd appreciate audience feedback. So get ready for that. So, and now please welcome Bruce Cherry for Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week.
Let the
music play, Bruce.
Yeah.
What do you got for us here?
First of all, I want to clarify why I've agreed to come on the show.
Okay,
this intro was humiliating.
What do you?
No, I've been trying, like I've been pitching wild pitches at this show for like months, and I have been unable to come up with. And no, just because I have a justifiably.
Justifiably what? Homicidal?
No. So I don't want to get up at 5:30 a.m., okay?
Oh, okay. So this is it's not a creative problem with you. See, I was under the impression that you're right. You're right. You're right. You're just not doing your job.
Let's give a little... little background
all right.
For the people out there, and that
okay.
is that we had a pitch meeting.
Yes.
And incidentally, Barry does not have a character either, okay?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Also
you're right.
Very talented.
Yes, very talented, but he does.
Behind the scenes.
But wait, you know, Barry.
But he's a narrator.
Barry comes down here and does Morning Sedition Radio Theater. Very big part of that. We couldn't do it without
him. Well,
you
know, okay. And you were handed gold a few weeks ago.
Okay. At that pitch meeting?
Yes.
What is the pitch? What's the pitch?
No, this is the mentality, okay? I mean, it was a beautiful pitch, and as I will explain, it is entirely within the realm of the show, and it is perfect
right, well,
for
maybe
the show.
I'm
the... Okay, but no, this is the mentality. If you guys were auditioning, like, for a musical, it would have been like, man, that guy sings great. Let's have him audition every week.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? I mean, just give it to me. Listen, okay, we're going to do it, okay?
Maybe I misheard.
What the hell is he saying?
I know what he's saying. He's saying he feels ashamed that
I feel no shame!
That his bit...
You don't know what he's saying either.
No, I do. He's mad that his bit is actually pitching a bit.
I know, pitched a beautiful bit, and they're like, boy, that was goofy.
Maybe
you must be some kind of buffoon.
Maybe I misunderstood it. Let's hear it.
Okay, this is it. The character is called Bernard the Credulous Pirate.
Okay.
And he believes everything that he hears. That's the whole shtick, right? In fact, the guy's obviously not even a pirate. I mean, somebody told him he's a pirate, and he believes it, okay?
Okay, all right.
Okay, and then And we start out every time with, like, we establish his credulity with something like, you'll say, oh, hey, Bernard. I mean, he'll call in and say, hey, Bernard, I hear there's a Spanish galleon in the East River. And he'll be like, arr, a Spanish galleon, pieces of eight, arr, arr, arr.
Okay, let's try. Okay. Let's make it topical. Let me try. We'll improvise. Hey, Bernard, Karl Rove, I think, is guilty of treason.
You're skipping ahead. I'm
sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's fine because we're getting to that now. Okay. And then the gist of it, because you have to tie it into the general zeitgeist of news, which is what the show was about.
Okay.
The gist of it is then you mention like some huge lie that the Republicans have done, like, hey, Karl Rove has not been involved in any of the Valerie Plame stuff, and uh-huh. the 12 hours didn't matter.
Uh-huh.
And Bernard does not go for that. Arr, sounds fishy to me.
Oh.
And boom, and that's how it relates to the concept of the show. And then you have to go out on a kicker, and I wrote in Riley for this part. This is what, at the end of every one?
Oh, the brother gets some love.
Yeah. That's right. You lean in and you say something to the effect of, listen, Bernard, Mark Maron has treasure in his butt. And that's... I respond with my usual arr, there be treasure, and then there's this uncomfortable moment as you try to...
You mean like the one I'm having now? So this So let me get this straight. So every week you do this stupid character you've come up with.
Pretty SpongeBob to me,
bro. You're prejudicing the audience with adjectives like stupid.
Am I mistaken, or is the punchline of this that we get to go searching in me?
Lower colon. I mean, okay, that's a comedy. But like, wait, staple.
But I don't even understand the funny of this. So it's a credulous pirate. All right, the pirate.
That's funny.
Chris, am I missing
something?
He believes
everything. Caleb. It's not the funny pirate voice. The two funniest voices in the world are drunk Scotsman and pirate. It's got one of them.
Drunk Scotsman?
Do you do a drunk Scotsman?
No, in fact, I can't do
because
accents,
that's
fine. I wrote that in.
But you can do the pirate.
I will slip out of the pirate. I'll be like an elderly Jew, but within three sentences. However,
you're not
the
really
fact
selling
that this guy isn't. No, it doesn't matter because he's not really a pirate. He thinks he's a pirate.
Okay, so now I'm interested in this devolving into the elderly Jew. Can we go from I say Bernard, Karl Rove is looks like he's in trouble.
Eh?
That's it?
I told you I can't do accents.
Let's first do the pirate. Hey, I hear Rove's in trouble.
Arr, okay. Trouble?
Okay, yeah. Now the Jew.
Hey, trouble.
Sorry. See, I don't know.
Maybe I can do accents. That was
God,
pretty good.
God, am I glad
that
I never went to one of these pitch meetings before now.
Hang on. We've got some reaction from the general public. All right? You want to hear it? You want to hear the reaction? We're involving people. What?
Let's get the feedback.
I'm still not sold on the credulous pirate. I think you're a creative guy, you know, and I understand that this is just a really...
And just see Bernard, it's like it's not too much. It's not like Ralphie, where it would be like, oh, he's trying to be absurd.
What the hell is the difference?
Ralphie?
But what do you mean Bernard and Ralphie? We're talking about a pirate, a credulous pirate that turns into an old Jewish man. Am I wrong?
The Jewish man, that just evolved right now.
But that's actually funny. You know why?
Because you're Jewish?
Yeah, and I thought of it. Yeah, exactly. Well, you got to take a shot at me on the album.
I believe the whole point of this bit is to take shots at me. Excuse me for returning fire.
All right, Dale in Manhattan, what do you think of Bernard the Credulous Pirate?
What do I think of it?
Yeah.
I think it needs work.
Oh.
But you know what?
What?
I think you guys need some estrogen to balance the testosterone.
Are you offering yourself?
Yeah, you guys don't have any female voices. I mean, come on.
What are you talking about? No, I see. We had one, and that was beginning of this.
In defense of the show, I will say Jim Earl is quite effeminate.
Either.
Oh, you mean, what do you mean? We need a female to do voices?
Well, yeah. You know, women are funny, too.
Yeah, I know. My wife, Misha, was on the other day, and I we're going to have Maria Bamford on Friday.
Voice?
We have some on the morning on the morning's edition Radio Theater.
Yeah.
Why, you want to do some voices, Dale? Is that what's up? Okay. Whoa. Thank you. Excellent.
Bruce, you're out.
I think that you were just your pitch was just upped by a pitch. Dale pitch.
That was a caller with an agenda. Obviously, they're not going to approve
that feminist agenda
because
that's right. It was still about you. I was taking another pitch from Dale, who did the.
It is still about me.
James in Miami, what do you think? What do you think of Bernard the Credulous Pirate?
Well, I'm a little bit concerned for Pops Riley there. I feel like, at any moment, since he's buying all those condoms, he could come out of the closet, homophobe, you know, with the treasure in the butt. I'm just a little bit concerned.
Wait. I had nothing to do with the treasure in the butt part, okay? That was not me.
They wrote you into that part.
So oh, yeah, they did write me into the part. Yeah, what are you doing, Bruce? Write me into some treasure in the butt spot.
It was a star turn. Everyone closes on you.
Thanks for your call. Let's see. We got one other
reaction. Pops Riley. Got
him. I didn't like that. That stuck. I love that stuck. Who came up with
that? It's like Velcro.
You're guilty of that. That was
all I said was, people, you know, when you get to my age and people start calling you Pops instead of Poppy, there's a problem.
You got no one to blame but yourself, old man.
Oh,
Ricky.
Lord.
Ricky, what do you think of Bernard the Credulous Pirate?
Oh, not crazy about the pirate.
Ah!
But this guy has the paranoid guy that calls in, so he has a character, and it's great.
But we haven't used that in a long time. We kind of let that slide because, all right, well, look at that. So he wants to, thank you, Ricky. So remember,
he wants to hear your other character.
We came up with the paranoid guy.
That was the guy that was listening last year.
Right. That paranoid guy was, I enjoyed it, but we seemed to hit a wall with that. Why did we hit a wall with that? What happened with that?
It was convoluted. It was difficult to put together.
Oh, again, it was too much work.
You know what? In terms of generating the quality to which I'm accustomed
to. So you have a problem with doing the research and getting up early. Maybe you're not.
I'm being mischaracterized here. I believe.
God, am I glad comedians don't build cars? Jeez, right. You guys would be hilarious on an assembly line.
All right, look, the Bernard thing. Still, I mean, this is the second time I've heard it. I'm not in.
We're not feeling it.
Okay, and then I'm not even going to tell you about the leprechaun with AIDS.
What?
It's actually a good idea, and we'll explore that further.
All right. Well, so next week, the leprechaun with AIDS and another character.
Yeah, I did that.
Is that what?
I'll explain all that. We walk.
I thought you didn't
line.
Do accents a minute ago.
Well, leprechaun. The whole point is that I can slip in and out of the accent. I write my own limitations into the bits. That's the beauty of it.
Bruce Cherry will be looking forward to the next pitch next week. It's a pleasure seeing you. Could we have another fanfare, Chris? That's your farewell fanfare, Bruce.
Thank you, America. Everybody called in hated me. What is that?
No,
well,
I think they were screened. They were being very diplomatic, and there's still a full call. There's still a whole bunch of callers that we're not going to take because it's not all about you.
Yeah, because maybe they would laud me.
All right, we'll answer the phone.
Or maybe they would laud
we'll see.
You.
We'll be back in a second to wrap things up, Bruce. It's lovely seeing you so early in the morning, all sweaty like you are. What'd you just say?
Sorry to be so combative.
No, well, that's okay. Give us a little Bernard before we go.
Your butt. There we go.
All right, we'll be back.
Treasure.
Stay with us, 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Now, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Past the hour, land this thing. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Wow. It looks like we got one more call. This is Brian calling from Taiwan in relation to Bruce's pitch. The Credulous Pirate. Brian, what'd you think?
Arr, we like the pirate in Taiwan. You know, give us some software, some movies. We can take care of it here really well.
Okay, man. All right, we'll let Bruce know he ran out crying. Thanks a lot for your call, buddy.
Thanks a lot, man. Yeah. From Taiwan, no less.
Brian in Taiwan likes the pirate. Sounds like he's got the kindred spirit out there in Taiwan.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Bernard the Credulous Pirate. So now let's talk about this, Riley, because Michael Bloomberg is getting a lot of support from Democrats who have a lot of money. Now, it is not unusual in history that some Republican mayors of this city are sort of beyond party politics, and it's really about their personality and how they manage the city.
Yeah.
And that's happened in history before, and we all know that Michael Bloomberg is a Democrat For some practical purposes.
Well,
right?
Yeah, they say he's a Republican in name only, but he has opened his checkbook to the likes of Dick Cheney in the past. You know?
That's bad.
Yeah.
There's some things I don't like about him, but talk to me about why are all the wealthy people, the wealthy Democrats, and explain to me a little bit about how this works. Is it because they don't really have to give him any money? He's running his own campaign. Why would they bother to come out and support Michael Bloomberg if they are Democrats? Is it just that money likes money?
No, what it means is Democrats don't call. In other words, these folks that have a lot of money that traditionally support Democrats are sending out a signal to the Democrats here in New York saying, look, don't bother calling me asking for money. I don't have to give any money to Michael Bloomberg, but I'm certainly not giving any money to you.
What's this going to do to your buddy Freddie Ferrer's campaign?
Make it more difficult for him to raise money,
yeah.
Which is always a problem. Remember, Michael Bloomberg has an unlimited amount of money, and the way things work here in New York, for those of you who don't know, there are some very strict campaign finance limits for those who decide to be a part of that system. Michael Bloomberg, because he is a billionaire and independently wealthy, has always opted out of the system, which means he can spend as much or as little money as he chooses. He has been spending copious amounts of money up until now, more than all his Democratic opponents combined.
Uh-huh.
So what this says is, Democrats, you're going to have a problem raising the kind of money, whoever wins the primary, you're going to have problems raising the kind of money necessary to beat Mike Bloomberg. That's what this says.
So Gifford and Ferrer and these people have to...
Anthony Weiner, Virginia Fields.
Stay within the system.
They all are within the system.
Yeah.
But the problem is, a lot of the people that the Democrats traditionally tap for this kind of a race are not going to be there.
I'll tell you, outside of Gifford, when we had Ferrer on the show and we had Anthony Weiner, they were certainly had a real sort of populist feel to them, and they felt like they were going to go out and really talk to people. Ferrer's a very charming man with a lot of confidence and seems to believe that he can get his message across to a lot of the working people of this country, of this city.
Of the city, yeah. And right now Bloomberg has a 16-point lead on Ferrer, according to the polls. Don't think it's going to stay there. This race is going to tighten up so that by the end of October, you're going to see single digits, maybe 5-6 points between the two of them. It may even close out. Mark Green, who ran for mayor in 2001, had a better than 20-point lead on Michael Bloomberg after the runoff in late September of 2001. Hmm. By November, that lead had evaporated and Bloomberg won.
So this is going to get interesting.
Yeah,
either way, right now it's just a lot of this is early polls. It's not doesn't make a difference really.
Nah. It doesn't make that
and
much
you sort of knew that this is the way it was going to go.
Yeah, you kind of saw. As long as Mike Bloomberg did not hit any big potholes during the last 4 years, which he hasn't.
Right. Microsoft, listen to this. Microsoft's new web service for satellite photographs accidentally, and that's in quotes, left the Apple campus off of the world. Okay. Apparently, this is a new service where you can go and you can get satellite photographs of any little chunk of territory around the planet, I believe. And apparently, the little chunk of territory where the Apple Corporation has its campus in Cupertino, California, was just a vacant lot.
Yeah.
And they say, we're still testing it. That's from a photograph from the early 90s. It was before the plant was. Yeah, it was an oversight. Yeah, right. Now,
yeah.
The scariest thing about this is the actual Apple campus is missing. We underestimate just how much power Bill Gates has. So could you please, there's several thousand people who work there that we don't know where they are. They're in some sort of black hole or something.
Daily City.
No, but I think it's hilarious. So he's got this technology. And if you go to the Google similar technology, the picture of the Apple campus is right there. But of course it wasn't an oversight. It was either a joke or just a little dish.
Press the wipe button on the computer.
Am I right?
Yeah, of course.
Maren, have you ever actually used the Google Maps to do a satellite photo of your house?
No.
Oh, it's awesome.
Oh, really?
I did it in the office yesterday for the guys, and we found everyone's house and everything, and, like, it's crystal clear. Like, I can see my literal house.
You know, my wife had our deck painted. I should take a look at it. Can I see how the deck looks?
Yeah, sure. You know what?
you want me to just give you my address on the air?
Address.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, let me just do that. I'll tell you exactly where I live in front of everybody. No, it was getting pretty nasty.
Actually, you know what?
Oh,
I think last time I checked, your wife was sunbathing on that deck. What is it with you?
What's it with you and my wife today? What is it with you and my wife today?
Lord have mercy.
One of our writers is the same thing with an obsession with my wife. That's all right. You know, I understand. I find it flattering. All right. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes. The Space Shuttle Discovery has launched successfully. Watching the liftoff, Florida Governor Jeb Bush said, this is exactly the kind of thing Terri Schiavo would have liked if she hadn't been murdered by liberals.
Oh.
Democrats are calling for congressional hearings on the leak of Valerie Plame's name. 26 Democratic senators are issuing a letter to the press and might even stomp their feet and refuse to eat their vegetables. Republicans say they might have congressional hearings when they have all the facts, which means all the facts about everything that's ever happened ever. President Bush might make a recess appointment for John Bolton as UN ambassador. Appointing John Bolton right before the August break means the UN has a month to change all the locks. Although Congress and the American people have not backed Bolton, UN representatives can rest assured he has the full faith and credit of an obscure clause in federal law. Phrase of the day. Just work this into conversation. There's nothing like a diplomat who's not even diplomatic enough to get past Congress. Wake up, sheeple. World War V will begin next October when Bolton appears at the UN cafeteria in a Viking helmet and slays the ambassador from Ghana, declaring, who shall stand against me and my depraved retinue of hashish bespotted ape men? None can defy me.
Wow.
That's Did I say it. That right?
Yeah, Oof. You said it right. It took you out of breath, though.
Yeah, it did. That was a long one. So what do we got tomorrow? You got that in front of you there?
Yeah, we got Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller and comedian Paul Provenza.
I've met him before. Penn Jillette, we don't get along that well.
They're going to talk about their new film, The Aristocrats. And Morning's Edition Radio Theater approaches its stunning conclusion. Marin, it's been fun.
Yes, it has.
See you tomorrow on Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.